So, we all love a good story, don't we? We love those stories where characters that have problems against them. They have the odds against them. They have an issue and they gain the upper hand against those that are more powerful than them. There are many examples in literature and film, and we seem to enjoy them a lot. We can think of the Lord of the Rings, folk tales, and I think in particular of the Narnia, where you have in the silver chair Jill, Eustace and Puddlegum spending and finding themselves in the giant's castle, welcomed, and they there are treated very well. Little do they know that the food they're being and the treatment is for them to be eaten. Yet these they escape. So we all love a story which involves people coming against a problem, an issue, a dark person who is spending their time attacking them, and then they are able to overcome that in some way. This is what we see here in Jacob and Laban. We see Laban welcoming Jacob as his kinsman, his mother's son, or his sister's son. Will Laban at this time that he's found himself in with Jacob do the right thing? Will Jacob, who has found himself trapped by Laban in his clutches, serving him for a long number of years for his wives, will he get back to the promised land? Will God hold on to his promise? Will he help him to get back to the promised land? God has promised him many descendants. God has said that he will bless him. He'll bless the nations and the families of the nations by crushing Satan's power. And this will come to pass later on when Christ comes. But he's not there yet. Will the promised seed that we've heard of in Genesis 3 come to happen? Will it be snuffed out by Laban and his tricks? Will Jacob become free from Laban? So we come to this passage. It's a long one, and the writer is trying to get us to think about the differences between these two characters. Quite often when Moses writes, he talks about the patriarchs in a way which makes us think, are they saved yet? Are they really trusting in God? And it's very difficult to know sometimes when that has actually happened. We think of Abraham. He was called out from Haran in Genesis 12, and he by faith goes out of that nation. Yet he then finds himself in Genesis 15 being believing in what God has promised, and God says that is counted to him as righteousness. So I want you to think of Jacob in this way as well. Is he saved yet? Or is he actually saved and he's going to be redeemed and to go to the promised land? So what we're looking at today is a culmination of Jacob's exile from the family in Canaan. It started in Genesis 28 and verse 12. That's where Bethel, Jacob in a dream, saw Yahweh. And he saw that flight of steps. You see there in Genesis 28 verse 12, it talks about it. It says, and he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. This is like the start of him going out of Canaan into the pagan world. And there we read at the end of Genesis passage that we just read in 32 that Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him. So we've got these two bookends, and we see Jacob descend into the pagan world, cross over the Euphrates to Haran, and then he finds himself with Laban, who traps him for his wives. He works 7 years as a wage for a marriage. Laban never really promised him Rachel at that time, but Laban deceives him into marrying Laban's oldest daughter, Leah. He then works another 7 years in payment for marrying Rachel and the one that he thought he was getting the first time. He finds himself with a messy family life, and he passively allows a war for his love between the two sisters, and the war to the birth of the children between them, and of course he adds the two maidservants as wives as well. And this time he's going through a trial. God is using this to change his life. And all this mess, the promise of Genesis 3:28 is being fulfilled. We see God promising that he would be with him. He'd keep him wherever he goes. He'll bring him back to the land. He won't leave him until he's done that. He also promises him that he'll have offspring that will take over that land and fulfill it, and that they will all the that your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. We've seen part of that already fulfilled. We have heard of Leah giving birth to Judah, and from that we'd see the tribe of Judah grow, eventually bring out David as king, and then from that the greater son of David, Jesus Christ, who was that offspring that was promised and will bring the families of the earth that blessing of salvation through Christ alone. So will God now bring him back to the promised land? It doesn't look very promising here. And this messy family, it doesn't seem in the what we were reading last week that Jacob seemed to be trusting God. You don't see him call on God in those difficult times. We heard God speak to him in Bethel, but that was the last time we really heard that that Jacob actually spoke to God. So this text in front of us, we've got three parts to it, okay? We've got the first part where God prospers Jacob, and that's Genesis 30:25 to 31:2. We have God prompting Jacob to return, which happens at Genesis 31:3 to 31:21. And then we have God's power overcoming in Genesis 31:22 to 32:2. And I want you, before we start looking at this, to think very carefully. We know what the story is going to be. We know what's going to happen in Genesis 31. We know the backdrop, the context of what's happening in Genesis 30. But I want you to forget 31, because that's after what happens in 30. And the writer is doing this, I think, because he wants us to focus on these two characters, Jacob and Laban. He wants us to look at that first before we start looking at how God is working in the narrative and their story. So please try to forget 31, although it will be very difficult to do so. So we are, verse 25. We see that Rachel has borne Joseph. And at this point, Jacob now desires to go home. His loved wife has now borne a son. He wants to go home. He has spent 14 years as a wage serving Laban for this wife Rachel. And he demands to return. You read it there when you see it. He says, send me away that I may go home and to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I've served you, that I may go. For you know the service I've given you. It's a demand rather than a request. He needs to go. It reminds us from the words of Abraham's servant in Genesis 24. In 54, he demanded the same thing, send me away. And Laban, even that time, when Rebekah was to go with Abraham's servant, was reluctant to let him go. Laban's response in both these situations tells us a little bit about who Laban is. He's a person who desires to keep hold of the things that he has. And he does what he's done before with Jacob. Name your wage. It didn't go very well the first time, did it? He named his wage and he got Leah. And then he got Rachel and 14 years of service, seven of which he was not willing to have done in the first place. He wants to go. But Laban's not going to allow him. And that's one thing he needs to do. Laban needs to give him that golden handshake, say, yes, you can go into the world, I'll send you back. Maybe give him something with that so that he can go with Laban's children and go back to the promised land. And Laban says, no, basically. He says, name your wages. He tries to manipulate Jacob by talking about how Yahweh has blessed him. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. He's trying here to say, look, Yahweh has blessed me. I'd like to continue being blessed. You have been the blessing that I have had. Jacob recognizes this and says that that's the case as well. But this divination, we see that Laban's basically trying to say that through his pagan ways he has found that Yahweh has blessed him. Jacob will have none of that. He says, you yourself know, you don't need divination, that I've served you and how your livestock has fared with me. And says that he has little before he came, but he has increased abundantly. And Yahweh has blessed him wherever he's turned. But he wants to provide for his household. If Laban's not going to allow him to go and give him that golden handshake, he wants him to be able to provide for his household. What shall I give you? Jacob says. He says to Jacob. And Jacob says, I don't want anything from you. I just want to go through the flocks. I just want to take the speckled and spotted sheep, goats and black lambs, and they will be my wage, and I will serve you for another few years. Why the speckled and spotted sheep, goats and black lambs? The reason is that Jacob just wants to show that he is trusting in God, I think. And that's because we're looking at Genesis 31. It's very strange. This is not Jacob, is it? He is a person who manipulates. He wants to have things for himself. But in this case, he is not wanting that. He's saying, I want the smallest part of the flock. They don't usually have speckled sheep. They don't usually have white on the goats. He's asking for the small part of the flock. A normal shepherd's wage would be 10 to 20% of the flock, plus the percentage of the wool and milk. He's not asking for that, he's asking for less. And so it reminds me of what God says through Paul in 1 Corinthians 1:27. But God shows what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God shows what is weak in the world to shame the strong. We've seen it and we know it many times in the Bible, don't we? That Gideon, Jericho, the many ways that he has used the small and the lowly to bring about great movement and changes in redemption story and to bring salvation to his nation. So he asks for that. Laban says yes, and Laban then goes and deceives. Jacob said, I'm going to be honest, this is what you find. Laban then deceives him and takes all of those sheep that would be his wage and takes them as far away as he can from Jacob so that he can actually keep them for himself, and Jacob can't actually increase and provide for his family. Jacob doesn't complain. It says, good, let it be. Laban goes and takes and sets it a big distance between them, and it says, and Jacob pastures the rest of Laban's flock. He does not complain. He complained when he got Leah, didn't he? Understandably. But here he doesn't complain. He can most likely see that the flock doesn't have what was there before, the night before when he had been through that flock as his shepherd. And he's no fool. But he doesn't complain. He's trying to show here, Moses, that we've got two men here. The man of the world, Laban, who is the deceiver that uses guile and is interested in material wealth, and he's a flatterer, and he will use Yahweh and Jacob to try and make himself prosperous. And we have Jacob, who was a deceiver but doesn't seem to be deceiving at the moment, who wants to go home and is thinking of that promise that Yahweh gave him at Bethel. He recognises that Yahweh's blessed Laban. He wants to provide for his household rather than being someone who's out for himself. We know he's not perfect, do we? Because we have this whole saga of the sticks and how he goes about it. But we're, in all of this, we see that Jacob has changed. He's changed in a way that we do not understand yet. We will find out that in chapter 31. But Laban is the man he was at the beginning. We have Laban and Jacob starting off as the same type of person. And we see Jacob going one way, and Laban continuing on his path. And that would be where Jacob would be, unless God had actually come to him and spoken to him and changed him. Jacob's actions here with the fresh sticks is something like a pagan folklore. It doesn't make sense, it's not scientific. The part where he does want to have the strong as his flock and the weak for Laban's flock shows some of his sinfulness still there. We understand that he is not a perfect person, is he? But we got here a picture of two men, one who tries to manipulate the wage, going out and taking them somewhere else. And then we have a person here, Jacob, who is trying to help God out, like most of the patriarchs try to do, and fail often. But God is blessing Jacob here. We see that he has been blessed, and he increased greatly and has large flocks, and female servants and male servants. And this sin of his, of actually going and trying to manipulate what will come from the flock, will come to bite him. But it's something that God uses for his good. So what can we think from this? What do we see? Laban, he takes God and Jacob and uses them as a talisman. He wants them to make him prosperous, reward himself. He wants the best of both worlds. He wants his pagan world where he can do his divinations. He wants the Yahweh who will bless him as Jacob is there. Yet, we'll see as we go through this that that will not last. He will become undone. And we see that a little bit already because Laban's flock is now feeble, and the sons of Jacob, of Laban, are saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he's gained all his wealth. So we have Laban not prospering anymore, and Jacob prospering. God has blessed Jacob. God is now no longer blessing Laban. And part of that can be seen also by the way in which Jacob now, instead of having Laban regarding him with favour, we have Laban now not regarding him with favour and turning his face from him, while God is turning his face towards him. Are you someone who has a talisman? Then you think, coming here every Sunday, you will get blessed by God. But you have not yet trusted in him. He is not your saviour yet. You think going about the process and the doing the good that you think you do is going to help you have the best of both worlds, like Laban. I can tell you, like Laban, you will not find that it will be prosperous in the end. Jacob changed, and we're going to see this now as we go through it. And I want to encourage you, yes, Jacob is a flawed person. He has got this issue of trying to manipulate the flocks and so causes himself trouble, but God is blessing him. That's how God blesses us as well. He doesn't want perfection in us, does he? He wants us to trust him, and he blesses us because of who he actually is. And why is that the case? This God that is perfect and holy. Well, it's because Christ has paid for our sins. He has taken those sins on the cross. He's taken Jacob's sins on the cross. He has taken the price that Jacob should be paying. And it is now Jacob that is counted as righteousness, who's the follower of Yahweh. He has got Christ's righteousness imputed on him. So God, been blessing him, is not going and being an unjust God, because the price has already been paid for what he's done. Let's move on. Jacob now is in a problem. He wants to return to the land, and he has now found himself in a sticky situation. It is difficult for him, and God comes and speaks to him. He commands him, go back to your kindred and your fathers. And then he gives him a promise, I will be with him. He has commanded him to follow him, and he is promising that he'll be with him. The gospel and the law, all in one short sentence. We have God wanting to be gracious to him and showing it. He knows that God is with him. He's seen his blessings. But now God tells him once again, I will be with you. Would that have been enough? We do not know. But we know that quite often in uncomfortable situations, God works well with us, doesn't he? With the difficulties we have, God will usually use them to prompt us and move us forward in our trust in him. And the command will be difficult because he's got this big retinue, big family, big flocks, lots of male and female servants. And Jacob is told, go, I will be with you. So he goes and speaks to his wives. So he goes and calls Rachel and Leah into the field in verse 4, where his flock was, and starts to talk to them. He goes to a place of secrecy, out away from anyone eavesdropping. Why did he do this? Well, because in Mesopotamia, apparently the legal code in those days was that if you wanted to move away from the family and the kindred of the wives, you needed to get the wives' consent. So that is what he's doing. And so he lays his case before these women. And he doesn't go, I here. He refers to the difference between God, who's commanding him to go, and what Laban's asking. So he goes and says, how does God work in their lives in comparison to how Laban has been working in their lives, their natural father? So in verse 5, he talks about him not being in favour with their father Laban. He's not regarding him with favour. But then he contrasts that with God blessing him. He has been with me. Then in 6 to 8, he then talks about the fact that he's been serving Laban and has done that with all his strength. And Laban has cheated him. But then he refers to God not permitting him to harm him. In verse 9 and 12, we see that he talks about what God has done to Laban. He has judged him. He's taken his flocks and given them to me. And in verse 13, he talks about the fact what God spoke to him. He said, I am the God of Bethel, when the angel came and spoke to him. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow of me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. Notice he wisely leaves out this deception of the wives. That might have changed matters, I think. But will they follow Yahweh or will they reject him? Will these two women stay with Laban with the comforts they've had all their lives, or go with Jacob and follow Yahweh? They know that the comforts they had with Laban are no longer there. They know that Jacob married them and it's been difficult, and Laban was the cause of that issue. So what do Laban and Rachel and Leah do? What do they respond by? These two women have been at war with each other for the love of Jacob and for his children. They say, there's no inheritance here. He's taken all our money. Notice he says, for he has sold us and has indeed devoured our money in verse 15. The dowry payments of 14 years of hard labour that Jacob had put down should have been kept in trust in case he abandoned them or they were widowed. And they're saying here that Laban has used it and devoured it. You see this selfish man? Yes, this man trying to keep everything for himself. And they have recognised that. And then they say, all the wealth that God has taken away from our father actually belongs to us and our children. So go and do what God has said you to do. So they will be going. And then we have a big tension start in this story. We have two stealings happening. We have Jacob stealing Laban's heart, which is how you can translate that part where it says, and Jacob tricked Laban the Aramean. And we also have Rachel stealing the household gods. We'll start with Rachel, first of all. Why did she do it? We're not told. Many people say lots of things. Whether it was to possess the family house of gold meant she had the inheritance, or whether it was to stop Laban using them for divination, or whether she was trying to shake the household gods' hold over Laban, or whether she wanted their protection. But later on in this, I think it's really important. It's the contempt Rachel has for these gods is evident. And she does it out of spite to unsettle her father. We know that they will become a snare later. But at this moment, we do not know why she's done it, and we'll see that later. Then we have Jacob. He steals the heart of Laban. That's what tricked means. We don't know why this was stealing the heart. People say that most likely this meant that he went out of his mind. He was irrational. He lost control of himself. It might have been the monetary loss of having all these people that were his taken away. It could be that he was not telling him. Or it could be that Laban's was innocently taken away, those household gods. But we also have here a very marked change in the way he talks about Laban. Laban is the Aramean now. They are different. They are different people. And this is the start of this difference between Jacob and Laban, this text. So this section, what can we learn from it? We've got Jacob obeying God. He's now, we can see that it was in faith that he was actually following God. God actually told him that the speckled sheep, etc., would be his, and he was following God. Jacob's self-sufficiency in the past has now changed. He's now turning and trusting in God, and God's called him to obey him, and God has been gracious to him, and he is going to go the way that God has told him to do. It reminds me of those words that we have in Hebrews 13. I will never leave you nor forsake you. This is where Jacob is going to be standing as he flees. God's reminded him of the vow he gave that he would follow God, but he's also reminded him that he's gracious and he will care for him and look after him. Lee and Rachel, they've been given that choice. Will they follow the true God of Jacob, or will they continue following and being with Laban? Will they stay in the pagan world and reject Yahweh, or will they go the way of God? They had that choice. We have that choice this day. We see that God is keeping his promises. He's blessed him. He is the God of promises. And he will keep you no matter what if you're one of his people. I will never leave you nor forsake you. The last section. Laban is mad. He goes and he pursues Jacob in verse 22 onwards to 25. And it is the words of warfare. Notice the way he talks. He talks about we've got Jacob fleeing, we have Laban pursuing him with his kinsmen, we've got pitching tents, all very much warfare type language. So Laban is angry. He is going after him with malicious intent. He's got his kinsmen with him. He's going to take them back by force. Verse 24. But God. God comes to him. Comes to this godless man, this man that's not following Yahweh, and he speaks to him. But God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. So Laban overtakes him. He pitches his tent. But there is not that maliciousness that we're expecting to happen. He is now afraid. It doesn't say so in the text here, but you see he refers to, in verse 30, he talks about, in verse 29, it's my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob. And then the way in which Jacob speaks about God, in verse 42, he talks about him as being the fear of Isaac. And later on, in verse 53, he talks about he swore by the fear of his father Isaac. He's talking about God as being a terror. Laban has come across the terrifying, fearful God. And it has stopped him in his tracks. What is he going to do? Is he going to take them by force? No. What happens instead is that we have a courtroom scene happening in here. Laban has his kinsman with him and he comes to accuse Jacob. Notice verse 26. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword? The first accusation. Jacob has forced his daughters to come as captives. Is that true? No. We see that in verse 4 onwards. He goes and gets the consent of the two women. Then he says and talks about in a sort of very strange way as if he really does believe this, and if you do believe that he actually means this, I've got a bridge to sell you. He says these things, okay? What have you done? Why did you flee secretly and trick me and did not tell me that I might have sent you away with mirth and songs, with tambourine and lyre? And why did you permit me to kiss my sons and my daughters farewell? Now you've done foolishly. He's trying to look like he is an innocent, aggrieved father. We know fully well he's not that. And Jacob responds for these two accusations that he will have, because that's the first accusation. The second accusation, and why did you steal my gods? So Jacob's response is, well, he was afraid that Laban would rob him or his wives and steal them by force. Seems justified, doesn't it? Did he trust God enough? Well, we won't know, but he did the right thing there, didn't he, in the fleeing. And he then says that he did not steal his gods. He's so convinced that him and his family have not got these gods that he pronounces the death penalty on the guilty and allows Laban to go and try and find the evidence against him. Now we come to the Laban searching. He searches all the tents. This is meant to show us, well, comedically, the futility of Laban and his gods. He goes around, going to Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and the two female servants, and then enters Rachel's. We're meant to be seeing these gods as these futile, inept things that aren't even able to save themselves. They can't even call out to him. He's searching for them, and he can't find them. And then we have what happens in Rachel's tent. This is Rachel's contempt for Laban's household gods. She has nailed her flag to the post. She is showing such contempt that she will sit on that seat with the gods underneath them, and she's in her time of menstruation. And in those days, that was a time of being unclean, and anything that was unclean that they were sitting on was unclean. So she is showing that these gods are unclean. One Bible commentator says this: she so shows withering contempt for the gods of Mesopotamia. So Laban there hasn't found these gods. We see God, the God who has taken them out of exile, taken them to the promised land. We see these gods that have found themselves unclean under the inside a camel seat with Rachel sitting on them. Is Yahweh your God? Or are there gods that you have in your life that are as unworthy as these household gods that could not help you in the time of need? They weren't able to help Laban. He is distraught. And he comes back, no evidence, so Jacob, 20 years of working for this man, starts a tongue-lashing against him. We can't go through it all, but I'd like you to see there that he talks about being accused and saying, what's my offence? What's my sin? You've hotly pursued me. He talks about the fact that he's worked for him 20 years. He tells about the fact that the female goats and the ewes have not miscarried, and anything that has happened to the flock, he has actually taken it and taken the price for himself. He shows his faithfulness to Laban. He shows Laban's dishonesty by cheating him and changing his wages often. He talks about how he served, and then he says, if it wasn't for Yahweh, he would have gone home empty-handed. Verse 42. If God of my father, the God of Abraham, the father of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God saw my affliction and the labour of my hands and rebuked you last night. What can Laban say? Jacob has given God all the credit. He said that God has rebuked Laban the night before when God met him in verse 24. And he is undone. Kent Hughes says this about this scene: it was all the grace of God. Jacob's grateful spirit on God alone. This was pure triumph. Jacob, the man whom God's hand had given people and possessions, stood high above Laban the Aramean. How sweet it was. This is the justification of a man of God being accused by Laban. We can see that in our own lives. If you're one of God's people, Satan accuses you. But we have Christ, our advocate, who justifies us, and he stands as our advocate, and we can stand tall, that Satan's accusations will bear no hold over us. And that's what's happened here with Jacob. It's a picture of that that's happened to us. So Laban's weak response is whiny, to say the least. The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day for these my daughters or for their children whom they've borne? Jacob is vindicated. The God of Jacob is seen as strong and powerful and able to save. The gods of Laban are seen as being weak and unable to do anything. So what does Laban do? Like all that come across the patriarchs and find that the God of the patriarchs is strong and powerful, they make a covenant. So this is what happens next. And they make this covenant, a pact, a non-aggression pact, and Jacob doesn't need this covenant, but it will recognize Jacob as a nation away from Laban, the Aramean. Jacob puts a pillar up, which he did at Bethel, and he will do again when Rachel dies. He puts the heap of witness, the Carn stones, and it's a play on the name Galeed, which is the heap of witness that they name this area for. These two witnesses will witness to the fact that they are now being separated and they will deal with each other in a right way. Jacob's oppression, is now gone. He's free from Laban. We hear Laban make a little slight about his daughters. If you oppress my daughters, or if you take the wives beside my daughters, what were the servants, I wonder? Although no one's with us, God is my witness between you and me. He's only calls upon Yahweh to watch between him just to make sure that he doesn't do anything bad. Okay? So we have Laban swearing to pagan gods there. Talks about the God of Abraham, which can be translated the gods of Abraham, the gods of Nahor, and the God of their father. So he's talking about plural gods. And that Jacob swears by the fear of his father Isaac, the terror of Laban. And we see Jacob offering a sacrifice. And then Jacob has a meal with his kinsmen. And Laban departs, never to come across the narrative again. Jacob goes back to the promised land. That's where he's going to go. And after this ordeal, what does God do? He meets him. He says, God went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. So he called the name of that place Mananaim, which means two camps. So here we have, at the end of this cycle, what has happened? We have a man who has been exiled and gone into the pagan world. We have Yahweh seeing him at the beginning and promising to bless him and promising to be with him. Jacob finds himself in a mess of a life there in paganism and in Laban's world. He then takes his family through only God's work and trusts in God and takes them away from the pagan world towards the promised land. Jacob was trapped. Only God could redeem him. He could not go and do anything else but trust in God. Not only that, Jacob is like Christ. He takes these women from a pagan world and takes them with him to the promised land. They're now free of the tyranny of their father. That's what we have, isn't it? We have been freed by Christ from the tyranny of the devil and the flesh in this world and been taken into that promised land. We're going there now. Take that as comfort. God said he would be with him. He says he'll be with us as well. So make sure you hold on to that promise in those difficult times that we all face. He is a promising and promise-keeping God. Think of Laban, this man who has tried to deceive and take things. What's happened to him? No more on the scene. He's gone his way. The idols of this world have had their way, and he is captured by them, probably goes and makes some more and worships them again. Yet he has not got Yahweh. He's not got a promised land. He will not be redeemed. Where do you stand? Are you one of God's people? Has Christ died for you? Have you trusted in him, like Jacob has done? Or are you trusting in the things of this world? We will see this really important section is a foreshadowing of what will happen later on. When Moses wrote this, that was a foreshadow of what will happen in Exodus. And we'll see this time and again. Pharaoh welcomes him, Laban welcomes Jacob. A different Pharaoh comes and oppresses him, Laban oppresses Jacob. God judges the gods of Egypt, Rachel sits on the gods, the household gods. Egypt's plundered when Israel leaves. Jacob plunders Laban. God does that for him. He crosses the Euphrates. They cross the Red Sea. They reach the Promised Land. He's going towards the Promised Land. He's in Gilead, which is overlooking the Promised Land and the Jordan Valley. That's where Christ is taking us as well. So I want you to lay hold of this. God keeps his promises. He takes his people from this world into his kingdom, and we will get there.